Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable for this Monday morning. It is the 19th of April, and we welcome you to the program. It's nice to have you with us. It's a beautiful day, and we're glad that you are here. Let me introduce everybody to you, and then we'll get started. We have a lot to talk about, and we will do so in short order. Let me just, introduce everybody and make it all official, and then we'll get started. Here we go. Alan Chartok is here. Good morning, Alan. How are you?
Good morning. Short order cooking indeed. And I have to say, it's nice outside and I feel good.
Excellent. Good. All right. We check in with, let's see who's actually on the phone. Political consultant Libby Post is here. Good morning, Libby. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm well. Very nice to have you on the program as always. We appreciate it. Sarah Rogerson is here. She is professor at Albany Law School and director of the Immigration Law Clinic. Sarah, good morning. How are you?
Good morning. Happy Monday.
Well, thank you, and to you as well. And Malcolm Nance joins us, counterterrorism expert, best-selling author. Malcolm, good morning. How are you?
Good morning. Good to be here.
Wonderful to have you with us. Okay, so let's get started on our program, and we begin with the, well, it's the final phase of the Derek Chauvin trial in Minneapolis. It is wrapping up, and Minneapolis is bracing for unrest as Derek Chauvin trial ends that final phase. What we know of right now is that as of this morning, closing arguments are scheduled in the case. Officials, business owners, and residents across the city are afraid Minneapolis could see a repeat of the civil unrest that erupted after Floyd's death last May. The killing of an unarmed black man who was shot by a police officer during a traffic stop on April 11th has not only increased anxiety over the potential for violent protests and looting, but it has also created confusion over who is in charge of efforts to keep the city safe. Minnesota Governor Tim Walz, Minneapolis Mayor Jacob Frey, and the city police chief and the county sheriff all share in the role, but they appear to hold different views on how best to respond. Last week, thousands of Minnesota National Guard troops began deploying throughout the city, taking up armed positions along commercial corridors and in residential neighborhoods alongside police officials and officers as part of what city and state officials describe as a deterrent to potential looting and violence in response to the Chauvin verdict. We could get a final verdict by mid to late week, so we shall see. Alan.
Well, you got to hope for the best and prepare for the worst. Of that, there is no question. And, if in fact what we're going to find is that the verdict is for Chauvin, the alleged perpetrator, lots of police verdicts are in these kinds of cases, then they'll be held to pay. There's no question about it. And that will open a whole new round of problems. So we're all sitting on pins and needles and waiting for this verdict and hoping that it will be a just one. It's that simple.
Sarah Rogerson.
Yeah, I'm disappointed in a lot of the coverage right now that focuses disproportionately on what I would call bad apples or bad actors in the movement, in society, who take advantage of moments like this to do destructive things that are not part of the goals of the movement, right? And increasingly, I think what feeds into the tension is this idea that, we can't separate, that we need to have a disproportionate response when there are bad actors mixed in with peaceful and sizable demonstrations. And I'm nervous about what's going to happen because I don't think that the sheriff locally and some of the other elected officials are really sort of sending the messaging that's required in order to prevent escalation of conflict in the community. And that being said, I place that squarely on these systemic problems that we have that I know that we'll get into more. And I don't mean to assume that the verdict will not be favorable. But it's more probable than not that the verdict will not feel satisfactory because George Floyd is gone. And the systems that resulted in his death remain largely intact. And until we see measurable, sustained reform of those systems, we will continue to see movements push and people push, and the power remain in the military and show of force context, and not with the people. So we keep saying this, but this is a really historic moment to be alive. And I hope to be part of the solution as we sort of tease out the issues this morning.
Malcolm Nance.
Yeah, Veer is absolutely right. It's the framing that's happening right now in news media, and I work in news media, is that I'm saying the framing that they have in news media right now is the preparation for massive quantities of violence. And by doing that, what you're doing is you're setting the theme and creating this sort of bipolar world in which there can't be any justice if this verdict doesn't go as well as possible. And it pushes the themes that, you know, the black community needs this heavy hand of calling out the National Guard and the state police. The interesting component of this is all the major cities around the United States today that are preparing the National Guard and the police for this verdict. And that tells me quite a bit, certainly as an African-American man. One of the things that I noted when I was doing the research for my latest book about right-wing extremism is that last summer during the George Floyd protests, and I saw it myself and saw videos of this, the leading edge of all the violence and the destruction in the initial George Floyd protests, both in Portland and in Minneapolis, were white anarchist or white right-wing extremists who were coming out knowing that this would incite the crowd, smashing windows, enticing people to doing looting. Look, that's going to happen anyway. I'm from Philadelphia. I've seen a Super Bowl victory parade in my city. But to actually have agent provocateurs out there, they're going to be out there in force. And I hope that these communities, certainly in the black communities, that when they see these black bloc anarchist Antifa guys, or they see these people who are unidentified, they need to push them out. They need to get them out of the edge of the protest right away. And mainly most protests, 92%, can be peaceful like they were last summer.
And Libby Post.
I don't have all that much to add between among Alan and Sarah and Malcolm. I do think that if there's violence, I hope there's not, but I'm sure there will be one way or the other. I do think you will see the right-wing provocateurs coming in, dressing in hoodies, dressing in clothing that they think the African-American community will stereotypically dress in, and be the first one to hurl the bricks in order to blame the Black Lives Matters movement for the violence. And I don't think there's any question of that whatsoever. Last night I watched 60 Minutes, The Oath Keepers. They had a segment on The Oath Keepers.
Yep.
And there were like three people from somewhere in the Midwest who are part of Oath Keepers, but didn't condone the storming of the Capitol. However, they did say that it was Black Lives Matter people who went and stormed the Capitol. So, you know, everyone's being brainwashed on all sides here to think that it's going to be the other person, the other organization, the opposition, to make our side look bad. We've seen this happen here in Albany. We saw this happen in Albany, and we will continue to see this happening everywhere else where the right wing does know what they're doing in terms of inflaming hatred and inciting violence.
Malcolm, you were talking about I think both you and Sarah were mentioned about cities across the country. So what is it now that we do, not just in anticipation of this jury verdict, but going ahead and inevitably, I would assume, similar cases across the country that will unfortunately happen, because right now we seem to be in the cycle where they happen all too frequently?
Well, I just think it's unfortunate that major cities like New York City, Philadelphia, and others are leading not with quiet preparations for the possibility of violence, but they have it in their heads that Black Lives Matter, which is just a civil protest movement, is some sort of threat that requires thousands of National Guards people. Look, it's not Black Lives Matter. Black Lives Matter is every black person in America. There is no organization. I mean, there is an organization, but it's the mindset of every African American in this country. And by making a lot of preparations, you know, for violence and extremism, they're putting out the message that we think you people are violent. Okay? Mm-hmm. Well, again, I'm from Philadelphia. I've seen both the Super Bowl and the World Series won in my city, and they devastated the downtown of Philadelphia to the point where they have to preemptively start taking down poles. You know, in Center City, because, you know, they're $200,000 light poles, because the average Philadelphian will rip them apart if they have a victory. Well, you know, America has a great history of protest, and it's one of the things that we cherish. But when African Americans do it, it's always considered some major mortal threat to the stability of the United States. And that's the exact issue that's at stake here. African Americans are treated differently when it comes to law and order. We want law and order. We want cops. We want our police forces funded. What we don't want is to be seen as an immediate threat by police who kill people due to their mere existence. And I train cops all the time. They do have a warrior mindset. They do have a guns forward mindset. But it's weird because the people who have all the guns are not African Americans.
Alan?
Well, my hat's off to Malcolm, of course, because he knows it, he's lived it, he sees it. I think that the idea of stereotyping the other guys is always dangerous. Nevertheless, I think some lend themselves to stereotypes, which always have a grain of truth more than others. I think the idea that black people in America are this united force, no, they're the ones who are picked on the most. Crime happens to black people more than it happens to white people, and we know that. So it's disgraceful to stereotype them as a crime-minded group. It's just part of what we live with here in the overall racist America.
Sarah?
Yeah, well, and it reminds me, I was rereading the letter to Southern women written back in the 60s by a woman who was a white ally to the civil rights movement. And it's a good reminder of how our society sort of talks women, and I would put business owners in this category too, into believing that you need a show of force or protection, or you need to have a heavy police presence in order to avoid black violence, right? And it's a myth. It's a story that we tell in order to continue to feed into these systems that are broken and to believe that they're required for our safety. And the way that we tell these stories feeds into that as well. That we have a long history and tradition of convincing ourselves that we need to protect, you know. And I would say that there is also that healthy slice of police that feel like they think that this is what they have to do to protect, and that it's not. And if we invested more in service And this is too late, right? The stage has been set. It's too late now. I mean, it's not too late to draw down the National Guard. It's not too late to make a decision behind closed doors and to get all law enforcement on the same page instead of being confused and having different avenues for crowd control or crowd response, to resist the deployment of chemical weapons on our fellow Americans. You know, these are things that are not too late to do, right? And to focus on bad actors as opposed to protesters generally. But they're even at this point in Minneapolis, they're targeting the press. The press have been lined up by the police and marched through a line to have their photos taken. They're shooting rubber bullets. A journalist broke two bones in his hand. The police broke two bones in a journalist's hand as he was holding his camera up to his face. And rubber bullets are not supposed to be used above the neck. We can't fall prey to the myth that this is what is needed in our country. It's not.
Let's pause there. When we come back, we'll continue. We have many letters on this subject, and then we'll move on to other ones as well. Panel at WAMC.org if you would like to join us. Panel at WAMC.org. We'll be right back. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Lots of letters from folks, and I want to get to as many as we possibly can. Alan Chartok, Libby Post, Sarah Rogerson, and Malcolm Nance make up the panel this morning, so let's get to some letters. Mike says, right now we don't know what the verdict in the George Floyd murder trial will be, but I believe there is a better chance for holding bad cops accountable because of the body cams that police officers, for the most part, now wear, and the videos taken by bystanders. Years ago, these videos didn't exist, and bad cops rarely were held accountable. We also go to Robert. I'd like to ask what Malcolm sees as a possible coming civil war if this trial does not deliver real justice for Black Americans. The demonstrations will become a shooting gallery for racist police. Malcolm.
Well, the demonstrations have always been sort of a shooting gallery, and you see the really heavy-handed. And I'm afraid to say many of them are conservative, and they exercise their politics, you know, when they go around shooting journalists and with rubber bullets and batons. And can I point out something? The kind of ordinance that they use in Minneapolis and in Portland on any given night is a fraction of what they exercised on the day of the insurrection in Washington, D.C. Right. They use no sting balls, no flashbangs, no multi-bang grenades and things like that. So I don't think we're going to civil war, all right? We are not going to civil war. There are people out there called accelerationists, like the Proud Boys, the Boogaloo Boys. They want civil war. These guys are living a Timothy McVeigh, you know, fantasy life. But the Black community just wants justice. That's not so hard to ask for. Everybody else gets it. We want equal justice under the law. And now, I mean, I can't see the case in, turning against Officer Chauvin. If that doesn't lead to a conviction, just on the strength of the video alone, then something's really wrong with the system. It means Black people are not entitled to equal justice in the United States, and that police have immunity. And this will lock that up. And that's where you're going to get unrest. But we are not going to civil war.
Linda writes, don't say Blacks don't have guns. How many African Americans kill each other every day in Chicago, Los Angeles, etc.? No one will ever admit that problem is big. It's awful. It's heartbreaking. I do understand your position, though. That is to Malcolm from Linda.
Yeah, well, I own guns. But let me explain something. The guns that are used in inner cities are generally stolen, and they are, and you wouldn't believe, there's a thriving rental market in these communities. I know, I've studied this. You know, I've studied gun sales in Baghdad and Chicago, okay? The amount of guns that are used for relatively very specific types of violence. But there are the United States is awash with firearms. I believe there's some insane number, like 300 million firearms amongst, you know, 20 million owners. You know, I'm guilty of that again, too. I own more than one firearm. But it's the question of the attitude of law enforcement when they see a black person, they assume they have a gun, and then they assume they're going to use the gun. And so they approach you as if you are automatically a violent felon who is about to kill them. I've seen videos of white subjects who were violent and would run back to their car, would shout at police or drive off, and they would be treated with complete deference. That's the issue that's being discussed now.
Mark writes and says, the reality in the United States is that the vast majority of black people, white people, Asian people, and any other race are good, decent people. That's what most of us have experienced and believe. However, our media and politicians benefit tremendously by trying to keep us divided. They gain power and money by pitting one side against the other. They give a very large voice to a very small number of people. It needs to stop. Ask yourselves if you are part of the problem or the solution. That from Mark. Erica says, okay, now all agencies are on alert. What is their job again? To protect and serve? So they should not be lined up across from protesters who usually don't assault each other. They should only be lined up in front of businesses and residents and on street corners to direct traffic, right? Right. They need to change their formation. Anyone want to comment on these? Just jump right in. I'll go to Gregory. The way to avoid violence is to accept the verdict and not to protest at all. Ken.
Yeah, well, but that's not going to happen, obviously. I mean, you can
shouldn't. Just accept what happens if it's unjust. Don't go into, you know, let's not even talk about civil disobedience. Let's just talk about standing up and saying, hey, this was wrong. You know, we have many, not all, judges are not infallible either. We have a long history in our country of really awful judicial opinions. Terrible ones. And if we don't say it's wrong, and if we don't stand up, then it will continue to happen. And so, I couldn't disagree more on that one.
Alan?
Yeah, no, I'm right there. Obviously, you have to speak out, and you have to do what's right. And, you know, if it calls for protest, you have to protest.
Ken says there's a scenario that I'm worried about that I haven't heard discussed in the media, which is what would happen if there is a guilty verdict resulting in a police riot like the ones we saw over the summer. Imagine a peaceful celebration being brutally attacked without provocation by law enforcement who are angry about the outcome. Could that happen? Malcolm.
I'm sorry, I didn't quite understand that question again. Could you read it again?
So basically, yeah, they're saying that is it possible that instead of the people in the street protesting a verdict, that if Chauvin is convicted, that the police would riot?
No. Look, police just want to go home, right? They want to, hitting the donut shot is not an untrue thing. Look, these guys just want to do their job. Now, right-wing extremists...
Please send your letters to Malcolm Nance. Go ahead.
No, right-wing extremists, on the other hand, are a completely different animal. Okay? It's possible you could see some protest, but no. This is a civil issue, and one part of society is upset that they're not getting their justice, but the other part of society that's getting it, they're getting it. What have they got to protest against? That they got one cop who was horrible. I mean, we all saw the man. He's horrible. Even his entire law enforcement agency came out against him. So, no, there's not going to be any issue with regards to cops protesting.
Kerry writes, how can you say that these so-called protests are peaceful? These protests are riots, and people are burning down and destroying their own cities and towns. Libby?
Go ahead.
Well, let's do Sarah and then Malcolm and then Libby. Go ahead.
I would encourage anyone who hasn't been to a protest to go to one. You don't have to hold a sign. You don't even have to be in front. You don't have to chant or yell. Just go. Walk alongside. Observe. Just spend an hour watching one. I have been to hundreds at this point of protests, and as Malcolm said, the vast majority are peaceful. And even the ones that get heated, where tactics are used to close down roadways or what have you, when the police respond in a way that protects people. And by the way, we're assuming that the police need to be there. Most organized movements have their own security that are trained in traffic management. And a lot of times it's movement security working alongside or in companionship without conversation to police. In Albany, that's the response, is to make sure that people can protest safely. And it never bumps up a notch until, in my experience, the police react in a way that is disproportionate to the pressure being applied by the protesters under this guise of safety and security. There are times when things escalate from there, and I'm not going to say it's always the police who escalate, but de-escalation tactics work and keep the vast majority of protests calm, and it's a choice, and it changes from jurisdiction to jurisdiction. So in jurisdictions where you have poor police management and poor de-escalation tactics, you see the violence rise much faster. When you have areas that have these insurrectionists, predominantly white insurrectionists, provoking violence, it only takes one gun to turn a whole protest violent in the public eye, unless you've been there and have seen it happen. You know when it happens as a protester, and you know you have a choice. And oftentimes what I have seen, especially in organized movements, is a move away from the violence, de-escalation within the group, and an attempt to reason or talk to the quote-unquote bad actors in the crowd, right? This is happening, you know, and it's an enormous broad brush to say that protest is always violent and completely inaccurate.
Malcolm.
Yeah, you know, this theme that the United States is on fire and that there are riots and cities burning from end to end, left and right, that is a Donald Trump-initiated theme. It is not happening. It did not happen last year. There was a couple of one or two block area in Portland around a federal judiciary building where there were nightly protests. But the violence was brought on by the police, by the federal agencies that were sent there by Trump to specifically attack those protesters. They had hundreds of Customs and Border Patrol special tactics officers there to specifically attack people. If you have a protest, the law enforcement agency should facilitate your protest. You have a right to it. You have permits for it, and they should be there. The police should be leading you. Kumbaya. Everything goes along nicely. And then where there are these incidents on the outside, that's where law enforcement is required to do their job. There's always breakaways. But we've seen agent provocateurs everywhere. I actually identified a team of them in Philadelphia for a journalist. He said, Malcolm, what are these guys doing? I go, those people are black bloc. Their job here is to smash windows, get them out of your protest. And the black community immediately said, you're not welcome here. Nothing happened at that protest, right? But these guys had backpacks with ball peen hammers, sledgehammers, pepper spray. There is a group of people who want to do that. You know, we need to facilitate protests because it's the First Amendment in the United States, and law enforcement should be assisting with that.
Libby, anything you'd like to add right before we go to break?
No, I'm good.
All right. Hang in there, Libby. We'll get to you, I promise.
Worry.
All right. We'll be right. We have a lot more letters on this. We'll get to some more, and then we'll move on to other topics. I thank you very much for being with us, and we'll return right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion for this morning. We go to Stu, who writes, create regulations that prohibit drawing guns at a traffic stop unless directly threatened by someone with a gun. You don't need to shoot and possibly kill someone who flees from your traffic stop. You can call for reinforcements, follow them, allow a tincture of time to settle raw emotions, and maybe save a life. Carrie says, I just wanted to say that Malcolm is spot on this morning. We attended the Black Lives Matter march in Troy last June, and it was entirely peaceful, but businesses were boarded up and the police station blockaded. It was clear violence was expected. What was discovered in the days following the march was that several non-local white nationalists had attended the protests with a stock of weapons in their trunk, at least one of which was a police officer. The anticipation and perception of black violence is simply wrong. Paula says, I respectfully disagree with the letter writer who said that cameras will be more helpful in convincing bad police officers. There was a camera present during the senseless beating of Rodney King. There was footage of Tamar Rice's killing. I won't go on, but things will get better when good cops step forward to protect the public from bad cops.
Well, you know, I think that a very strong argument can be made that while it is not the final tool, that cops wearing these things will prevent abuses. I don't think there's any question about it. If you know somebody's watching you at every moment, you're going to be more careful. Will that always work? No, especially because much of what we're seeing is from people from the outside with cell phones doing the observation. But I'm all for cops wearing cameras.
Sarah?
Well, we saw an incident happen in Albany where a deputy was recorded saying racist things. An action was taken. So there is something to be said for the use of body cams. But the problem is, again, what is the return on investment? You know, how many statements do we catch? And by the way, we're catching behavior after it's happened. What if we shifted our thoughts about where to invest money? Instead of investing in a technology industrial complex just to equip police officers with more stuff, what if we shifted those investments into public health and shifted those investments into supporting benefit structures that keep people out of poverty, that reduce crime overall, which reduces the need of police to respond? And what if we shifted those resources into, really reimagining policing, not a top-down, like, let's go through this conversation, and then at the end of the day, have fewer than half of the municipalities in the state of New York respond with police reform plans. You know, we really need to think about investments and what they yield, even when investments like body cameras ultimately do anecdotally catch bad behavior after it already happens.
I want to go to Anthony's letter, and he says, please don't give exclusive That's not Anthony's letter. Sheila's letter. Dear panel, I'm amazed by some of your panelists continuing to minimize the tremendous business and property destruction after some of the protests that followed a police killing a black man. Does anyone recall the looting and destruction on Fifth Avenue last year that had nothing to do with bringing attention to a just cause? Rather, it turned away a lot of people from being sympathetic to the issue or heavy-handed policing. So what do we do about that situation, panel?
That's where Malcolm calls it, the Asian provocateurs come in. Because really, those are the folks who are creating the violence more than the people that are actually honestly protesting. So, you know, I don't want property destroyed. And I don't think that it does any good for anybody to destroy property. The only groups that destroying property during a Black Lives Matter protest helps are the white supremacists, because then they can turn around and say, see, what did I tell you? And it's their folks who are doing the property damage under the, you know, coming under the guise of being an ally to Black Lives Matter and other kinds of protests. So, you know, yes, there was a lot of damage, and we saw what happened in the city of Albany the next morning and the next week, where people were going down into the communities that were affected along Central Avenue, along South Pearl Street, to help clean up and to help board up. And then there was, you know, emphasis and programming put on by the city to get people back into business and to get people back to using those businesses. And so, you know, destroying property, I get it. I mean, I understand that some people see property as the bane of all existence. But the fact of the matter is the overwhelming majority of us do not. And we own our, you know, many of us own our homes or we own our cars or we own our cell phones, and it is our property, and we don't want it destroyed. We want it to be protected, but we have to recognize who's really doing the destruction.
Similar letter here from Mac, who said, I just heard Alan, I heard Malcolm mention that he witnessed whites at the forefront of instigation and the violence that happened last summer. I don't necessarily doubt it, but I have not heard that assessment echoed in any official reports or primary media. I'm a regular NPR and New York Times reader, so limited to that, but didn't understand to be a clear takeaway. Did I miss something or was this suppressed? Malcolm.
No, it wasn't suppressed. You just missed it. If you want to hear about official reporting, the individual who committed arson at the police center on day one of the Minneapolis protest was a white supremacist who was arrested and imprisoned for that arson attack. And that was one of the key things that they were showing on Fox News, how this police department headquarters building had been set on fire by the protesters. Same in Seattle. We had individuals, at least three of them, related to the Boogaloo Boys, who were the leading edge of violence in that city and several other cities. The famous video in Santa Monica, California, with the two white, black bloc anarchist Antifa, and those people are really not Antifa, right? They're just, they protest at every protest, and they're violent at every protest. They went to the Starbucks in Santa Monica and spray painted blacks, you know, blacks are supreme, Black Lives Matter rules. And when a young black woman tried to stop them, they said, no, we're on your side. This is what you, you know, this is what you think. That's not what we think. All right. But there are provocateurs out there and people need to be aware of them.
We'll go to a couple more letters before the top of the break, and then we'll change when we come back. Gina said, when I first joined my first Black Lives Matter protest in New York City, my daughter told me, as a white person, take to the back, not the front. Follow their lead. Stay away from the anarchists and the police. That's always where the trouble is. Over 50 protests later, I found that to be true. Let's see. Anthony says, please don't give exclusive responsibility to right-wing protesters. I have no agreement or sympathy with them, but there have been tremendous acts of damage done by left-wing protesters and instigators. And I think that is it. Okay, excellent. Let's take a break. When we come back, we will continue. We will have much more to discuss. Lots of good topics. Alan Chartok, Libby Post, and Sarah Rogerson. Malcolm, you have to leave us now, right?
I think he left already.
He already left.
I'll stay on for a little bit past 10 o'clock.
Okay, good. All right. Great. So Malcolm will be with us for a little bit, and then he won't, and that's fine. Okay, we'll take a break. We'll be right back. Bye. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. Losing my voice there for a moment. I felt like I'm going through puberty. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable. Very nice to have you with us. Alan Chartok, Malcolm Nance, Libby Post, and Sarah Rogerson. So I know that I know Malcolm has to go, so I want to just get this story in, and then we'll move on to other stuff. And this has to do with the Capitol riot and the probe that is going on in Washington. So the headline in today's Washington Post says Trump's grip on GOP looms as support falters for independent probe of Capitol riot. Congress's pursuit of an independent investigation into the January 6th insurrection is facing long odds as bipartisan resolve to hold the perpetrators and instigators accountable erodes, and Republicans face sustained pressure to disavow that it was supporters of former President Donald Trump who attacked the U.S. Capitol. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi announced late last week that she had drafted a fresh proposal for an outside commission to examine what caused the deadly riot. But in a sign of how delicate the political climate has become, she has yet to share her recommendations with the Republican leaders, who shot down her initial approach, labeling it too narrow in scope and too heavily weighted toward Democrats in composition. So, Alan, let's start with you. How do we get get away with it?
They may well get away with it. Here's the issue. They sat there, the Republicans, and their lives were being threatened. They had a vice president who was being chased by the mob, and still, because of their deference to this particular man, to Trump, they are doing the exact opposite of what they should be doing. It's cowardice. It's awful. And I don't know how you stop it.
Malcolm.
I can say this unequivocally. There will be an independent commission on the Capitol attack. Just because the Republicans are resisting it, what they're really doing is they're saying 100%. They're just flat out against anything, any commission, any investigations whatsoever. That's not going to fly. We've already seen from the initial report by General Honoré that there has to be some sort of investigation. It could be delayed to allow the FBI to continue their arrest. They've had over, I believe they have 401 people have been arrested thus far. That number may double or triple. But for an actual probe, you don't need the Republicans. It would be nice to have a bipartisan commission. But, you know, I've spoken to people on the Hill about this personally. And one of the things that I recommended that it be headed by someone that both sides could trust, like General Colin Powell and, you know, some other person who is a conservative. But you have to understand, they don't trust anyone who is not a pro-Trumper. They are just so ruthlessly pro-Trump now that it doesn't matter. I mean, they could have killed 10,000 people in that building. They would oppose this thing. This would expose the seedy underbelly of what they have now turned into a fantasy that they didn't do it. It's absolutely amazing. But now the Republican political ideology is that they took no part in it. And none of these people were Trump people. One quick note. This last 3 days, there's been a conference on supposedly about the vaccination and health being run by the conservatives. And this last weekend, you saw the complete takeover of QAnon by some of the more fringe people, but an audience of thousands cheering on lawyer Lynn Wood, Michael Flynn, and others saying QAnon is the truth. So the Republican Party is quickly becoming a dangerous cult. But there will have to be an investigation. The nation requires it.
All right, let's go to some other story. I'm sorry, Libby, did you want to say anything on this? And Sarah, too, I apologize.
No, it's the statement that Malcolm just made, that QAnon is being overtaken by either even a further right fringe. I mean, it's just astounding that that's the case, because we thought they were as bad, as fringy as you could get.
So Libby, why is it happening in America?
I think there's a number of reasons why this is happening in America. I think that we have lost our moral center. We have and I keep going back to the fact that there are no more World War II veterans in Congress or in government per se, you know, in government, who remember what the fight was to fight fascism and who remember how important it was. A friend of mine said to me the other day that they were talking with their parent or, you know, somebody older, and said, this country could never fight World War II at this point. We just don't have it in us, because we coddle up with fascists and we like authoritarians. And I think part of it is that our money is going to fighting wars and building up a military that is unnecessary. And Sarah was talking about reallocating resources. Let's take 10 to 15% of the military budget and put it into education. And then I think we'll see a sea change. It's going to take a little while, but we've been gutting education. We've been talking about junk science. We've been dismissing fact. We've been undermining and denigrating anybody who thinks critically and uses critical analysis. And that's why this is happening. People want fast, easy to understand, digestible little facts that confirm their bias. And that's where we are as a society now, where there are some of us who still want facts and want to think. And then the vast majority of people just want it to be spoon-fed to them. They want to confirm that, yes, as a white person, I am being discriminated against because, oh my God, that black man's the principal of my kid's school. Why isn't it a white man? That just shows that blacks are getting further than whites are. Well, maybe it was because, you know, the whites couldn't do it. Maybe it's because they didn't go to school long enough and they don't have the education. Maybe it's because somebody actually could actually bootstrap themselves in this country still and get a good job and get a good education.
I think maybe it's because it's because they're losing power and they know it.
Well, that's all comes down to, is that it's about losing their own sense of what power is. And for our society, for America, it's about being white. It's just that simple.
Sarah Rogerson.
Yeah, that's a great note to end on.
Thanks, babe.
Anything you'd like to add?
Who's ending?
No, well, I mean, just in that segment. But, like, you know, that's the Poor People's Campaign said it in the 60s, and they're saying it again. Reverend Barber, and this, you know, this is making certain news media outlets, it's making it through certain social media feeds. And, of course, I'm solidly in those circles of constituents where I would see these things pop up more often than others. There's not enough attention being paid to movements based in fact. The Poor People's Campaign is a movement based in fact. The lived experience of poor people in America, the lived experience, you know, of war veterans in America who are saying we're not taking care of people. We need to stop the military-industrial complex. Right. Like, these are things that we could all agree on if we all sat down in some big gathering. I don't want to call it a congregation because I don't even want to add religion into this fire. But if we all sat together and talked about the issues and the facts and wanting to help people, it goes back to the beginning of the segment about how most people in the country want to help each other, no matter where they're from. And we're being lied to. And we're also self-seeking unhelpful information and passing it off as fact to each other. And we're all complicit in it. But when it's centered on whiteness and it's uncomfortable. You know, people don't go to protest because it's uncomfortable, because you don't get to sit in your house and order everything you need from Amazon, no matter how they treat their workers, and go to work on Zoom and cultivate a social media network where all you have to look at is your relatives, you know, cute babies and puppies. Like, that's not the world. It's a world that you can live in, unfortunately. And if you're white in America and choose not to pay attention to what's going on around you, but it will not sustain you. I guess that's all I have to add.
Good part to end on. Yes, go ahead.
You know, Lyndon Johnson, I love to bring this quote up every time we have this discussion, because I always have people who think, where did this all come from? Why are we having all this strife amongst the white community? Well, Lyndon Johnson once said, if you can convince the lowest white man that he's better than the best colored man, he won't notice you're picking his pocket. Donald Trump has mastered that. He has figured out that white grievance is the great untapped power in the United States. And he's right. He's absolutely right. There are people who are claiming that diversity destroyed America. Well, you know, the Capitol was built by black slaves. So was the White House. You know, the words around the top of the Capitol, the United States motto, E Pluribus Unum, from many one. They hate that now. They hate it. They want their tribe to dominate. And that, and they're running against the shoals of history. The thing is, they have no problem sinking this ship. if it means they could get away with it.
Anyone else on that? All right. No, go ahead.
It is the politics of grievance. It's all it is. And that's where it's about losing one's power. I mean, it really does come down to that.
All right. Let's go to this story. Here we go to the White House walking back an order on refugee limits after a backlash. It was a busy day Friday trying to keep up with this story. The White House walked back its announcement that it will keep this year's historically low refugee ceiling of 15,000 set by the Trump administration, saying its earlier statement Friday, which was panned by fellow Democrats, was meant only to ease restrictions from countries from which refugees are currently banned. The White House said President Biden would raise the cap by May 15th. Press Secretary Jen Psaki said the earlier announcement was made because Biden, quote, was urged to take immediate action to reverse the Trump policy that banned refugees from many key regions to enable flights from those regions within days. The order on Friday does that, she said. She said Biden would, quote, set a final increased refugee cap for the remainder of this final year by May 15th. The fiscal year ends September 30th. Sarah.
Oh, boy. So 15,000 is the lowest ever in the history of the United States, first of all, ever, including after 9/11. In 1980, we admitted 230,000 was the cap. 230,000. And we didn't even hit the cap. And since then, there have been ups and downs, ebbs and flows. After 9/11, the cap dropped to, I'm looking at the numbers now, 75,000. That was the ceiling. And that folks actually admitted, as refugees, remember, this is you know, people who have experienced persecution in their home country or have otherwise been displaced and then been labeled refugees by the international community. Just less than half of the cap after 9/11 was admitted. We are far below that. And it is a shock and a bit astonishing. And that's why I saw lots of chatter in every single one of my networks of immigration policy folks, activists, immigration lawyers even. Because why do we have more people at the border? Do you know the vast majority of the people who are presenting themselves at the border are presenting themselves lawfully to seek asylum because they're refugees? Here's the thing. If we admit more refugees through lawful processes, we reduce backlogs at borders. If we have a historically low cap, like lowest ever in the history of the United States, of course we're going to have border issues, because it's not that more people are coming, it's that fewer people are being let in. It's that more people are presenting themselves repeatedly saying, I have no other option. I will die. And it's because people are dying when they're sent back.
So, Sarah,
that's happening.
So, Sarah, just to be clear, you're giving advice to Joe Biden. What do you tell him to do right now? Because clearly they're going back and forth.
Raise the cap immediately. I'm flummoxed.
Do you think if that happens, there'll be a political backlash, which they clearly are worried about?
Who cares? This is not an issue. This is biblical. Okay, this isn't like he's not saying free visas for everyone. You know, this is a process. You have to go through a whole process in order to be considered a legal definition of a refugee. There's a lot of paperwork involved and years of preparation involved before you can be presented,
okay,
like way more than many other types of visas. So,
okay, so Sarah, what do you think is going on in the White House right now? Why are they so flummoxed? I mean, the political realities are very important here. What do you think is going on?
I don't know. It was infrastructure week. There were lots of big deals on the table. I think ultimately what it comes down to is the frustrating truth, which is that every time we
need to save face politically. We do it on the backs of Black and brown individuals, and immigrants are an easy, quote unquote, target because the political ramification is far less than when the right shakes, you know, the rafters and pounds on the windows and scares Americans, again, this theme of fear, into believing that refugees are harmful to this country. This is directly the result of Donald Trump's 4 years of telling the American public that Black and brown immigrants are dangerous. And so the Biden administration, what do you do with that? What do you do with that this week? Yeah. With everything that the White House is going to be dealing with this week, not just in Minnesota, but everywhere else. It's a huge mess. Stephen Miller knew exactly what he was doing. And we are going to be dealing with this for a very long time.
Malcolm, any thoughts?
No, this is one I'll sit out on because, you know, she's absolutely right. We got rid of the caps. So now it just appears there's a lot more people because they're all stacking up by the door. Whereas we, you know, I don't know. I hope Biden is certainly making a thoughtful choice about how we can do this in a fair and equitable manner.
Libby?
You know, I think there's a lot, you know, Sarah alluded to this. There's a lot on the table. And I think that everybody wants him to move at lightning speed on every single issue. And yeah. I think that this fell off the table in a way that it shouldn't have. They will correct it. But there is a mess that they inherited. And, you know, I don't think everybody understands the enormity of how government works, or it's at times doesn't work, and the mess and how long it's going to take to clean it up. But there are people who just want it done right now. And
so how will they correct it?
What?
You said they'll correct it. How will they correct it?
They'll increase the cap. They're already talking about it. They're going to increase the cap. They're going to get, it might not be as much as people want. They're talking 65,000. Some folks want to go back to Obama era, which was 85,000, but they also have to deal with the surge at the border and to make sure that people and these children are treated with respect and not the way they were treated during the Trump administration, where we know that kids ended up being sexually abused and maybe even trafficked. So, you know, it's really something to, and you know, you had 4 years of these folks down at the border, the ICE folks, with the mindset that they could do whatever the hell they wanted with these kids. And now you have a new president and you have to change that culture along with changing the way the culture of the way the whole immigration system is going to work and how all of, you know, getting these folks into the country is going to work. And so it's not going to be easy because they really inherited, you know, this whole notion of build back better. It's like building back from nothing.
We have a couple of letters and we have just a few minutes before the bottom of the hour break. We go to Ricky. The horrendous videos of the Capitol riot can be shown over and over again to energize Democratic voters in the 22 and 24 elections, leading to victory and demonstrating the importance of Trump and his movement. We then go to Douglas, who says, thank you, Libby. Where is our next great generation? This country isn't what it used to be. Great conversation. There's one for you, Libby.
Can you say that again?
Sure. Thank you, Libby. We love you, is what the beginning of it says. Is that the part you want me to say again, or do you want the other part too? Okay.
No, I want the other part.
Okay. What is our next great generation? Which I think is the key question. This country isn't what it used to be. Great conversation. So, where is our next great generation?
The people that are taking matters into their hands in a constructive way, the folks from Black Lives Matter, the folks from other progressive organizations who are really making a difference. That's our next greatest generation. if we can manage to listen to them and learn.
Alan,
well,
you know,
well, it's a very interesting point. I think so much of what is happening is because the Republicans and the former white majority is aware that they have now lost it, and they're holding on to the life raft with everything they've got. They know that this is going to end up making the United States a very different country. In which equality, in which economic equality is going to become very real. And so that's why they're acting out. I think it comes down to that.
Sarah?
I agree with Libby. There are a lot of great ideas out there, and we need to listen to the rising leaders in black and brown-led organizations, where the voices of directly impacted groups are amplified, and we need to listen to the people that are doing the work. We need to do more of the work ourselves, and by we, I mean white people, need to do more of the work themselves to understand the systems and structures that they've helped create, whether and or have participated in, have perpetuated the myth of America that is not experienced by a lot of the people, even that I care about in my own life, who still cling to white right politics. So we've got a lot of work to do. We need to take leadership cues from those who are directly impacted, amplify their voices, and keep working. And on that note, I have to go in order to do more of that work. I'm sorry.
Okay. We'll let you go, too. I think Malcolm has gone. So on the flip side, it'll be Libby and Alan. That's great.
Oh, great.
We're lucky we have Libby. Let me put it that way.
Yeah.
All right. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll continue. We have much more to discuss, and we would love to talk to you. Panel at WAMC.org. Panel at WAMC.org. We will continue our conversation with Libby and Alan and, of course, include your letters right after this short break. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. Very nice to have you with us, and we welcome your letters panel at WAMC.org. Alan Chartok is here, Libby Post, and again, we welcome your letters panel at WAMC.org. A couple letters here, and then we'll move on to some other topics. Tredane says, can we, the panel, so I guess you got. Give their thoughts on the America First Caucus and the mission language it is using. The fact that a caucus is being formed that isn't even bothering to camouflage their racist precepts, but borrowing literal white supremacist language from supremacist flyers and websites.
So who's surprised?
Yeah.
Not me.
Me neither.
Not me. Look, this group is out in the open. Look, they are following their former president. It's extraordinary. And speaking of presidents, if I could read a letter, Joe, there's a note from our friend Sheldon who says, what's the difference between the National Guard deployment in Washington, D.C. in January and the deployment now in Minneapolis? And that's from Sheldon, our friend. So what do you make of that, Libby? Seems
what's
clear
the
to
difference
me.
Between- The deployment?
Yeah, between the yeah, one was a group of people, amalgam of people put together, if I'm not mistaken, by the president of the United States. And I don't know that they were all National Guard either. If we're talking about the White House incident.
And in the state and in Minnesota, it would be the state National Guard, right?
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, there was a big I think that there was a big difference. I think that what happened on January 6th. Nobody was ready. Nobody was prepared. You know, even Pence asked for the National Guard to come out, and he didn't get any response from the White House. So, I mean, is that where the question was going? What's the difference between what happened
on January,
the law enforcement response?
Right.
Yeah.
And the
yeah.
deployment now in Minneapolis.
Right. I think the president, well, the idiot in chief, you know, made sure and his minions made sure that there wasn't a response and that Capitol Police were not prepared, and that, you know, the Metropolitan Police was made the fall guy in all this. in Minnesota, each governor has the ability to call out their state's National Guard. So it's a totally different group of folks. And, you know, hopefully.
And two different presidents.
And two different presidents. Two different presidents, but the governor of Minnesota calls out the National Guard. The issue is going to be whether or not the National Guard, the Minnesota police, and everybody else in law enforcement who are part of this are going to be able to work together and have the same perspective. The mayor has a different perspective on how things should be managed than the National Guard and even the police chief. So it's going to be interesting. And hopefully it won't turn to violence. The chaos won't turn to violence.
Well, if there's an acquittal in this or anything like it, there will be violence.
I can't imagine. I just can't imagine that there's going to be an acquittal.
Well, yeah. No, I would agree with that. But I certainly hope you're right that the jurors have their heads on straight.
Yeah, I just find
all it takes is one.
Well, and what Sarah was talking about earlier of the difference between a murder charge and a manslaughter charge, and will those who are gathering feel that justice is served?
If it's a manslaughter conviction, is what you're saying, right?
Correct. Right.
Yep.
Let's go to this.
Hasn't,
go ahead.
Hasn't well, he's been charged with second degree murder, so
right.
Yeah. Yeah, but libs gave him three different options.
Right.
And obviously they did that because they anticipated there was going to be trouble on that jury.
Right.
We should note that closing arguments are now underway in that trial. Chris writes to us and says there's no well-liked personality or rhetorical trick that is going to convince the GOP or the right wing to abandon Trump. Instead of pleading with the arsonist to stop lighting fires or debating with the arsonist about whether fire is bad, we need to empower people who want to put out the fire. That from Chris. Let's go to this story, and I've been reading a lot about this and have wanted to touch on it for a bit, and 33 states have introduced more than 100 bills that aim to curb the rights of transgender people across the country, with advocacy groups calling 2021 a record-breaking year for such legislation. Many of these bills are rapidly making their way through state legislatures. On April 6th, Arkansas became the first state to outlaw providing gender-affirming treatment to minors, a move that the American Civil Liberties Union said would, quote, send a terrible and heartbreaking message to transgender youth across the country. According to data from the Human Rights Campaign, one of the nation's largest LGBTQ advocacy groups, at least 117 bills have been introduced in the current legislative session that target the transgender community. It's the highest number the organization has recorded since its beginning of tracking anti-LGBTQ legislation more than 15 years ago. So, Libby, I have two questions for you. One is the obvious, which is why is the are we seeing these record number this record number of legislation going through? And two, what do we do about it?
Well, you see this record number of pieces of legislation going through basically because of what we've already been talking about, the white supremacists, the Christian right, the right-wing fringe elements of this country who are dictating certain political agendas in state houses across the country.
Yeah.
You know, transgender youth are an easy target. People and people in those states, unless you really want to educate yourself about transgender issues, living an authentic life, what that means, how people struggle with their gender identity, you know, you're going to have this knee-jerk reaction of, I don't understand this, it must be wrong.
Right.
And so, you know, that's what's happening in these state houses, and it's really being pushed by the radical Christian right. Now, you know, it used to be that we were the ones that lesbians and gays, you know, based on sexual orientation was the boogeyman in the room. And, you know, now the Supreme Court has said we're covered. And so you can't discriminate against us. Now the next avenue then is gender identity. And
find
people,
somebody else. Yeah.
Right. Well, there is that. But, you know, people don't understand. And what they don't understand, they're fearful of. And, you know, when you have kids saying at an early age that their gender identity is not the sex that they were born with, you know, some people just freak out. They just can't understand it. And the fact of the matter is that this is, they're trying to live their authentic selves and who they really are, to deny medical care, to deny their ability to compete in sports. It's just one more cog in the radical Christians' rights efforts to make this a straight, white, Christian country.
So the big question, of course, is how this stands up in the lower courts and how it stands in, obviously, the Supreme Court as it moves forward, which many of these, inevitably, they will, correct?
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, Trump was very effective in getting his people into the courts. And so, you know, it could very well mean that a lot of these bans will be upheld based on the politics of these judges and not necessarily on the law or on their own inability to understand. I mean, we've been taught every time the news comes on, you're hearing the story from Namibia about two gay men
right.
who had a surrogate child, I think twins maybe.
Yes, surrogate twins.
You know, in South Africa, and they're not letting them back in the country because it's not their biological children. I mean, it's such ridiculousness that happens when it comes to these issues. And gender identity in the United States is sort of the last sword for the Christian right to fall on, because they can no longer fall on the sexual orientation sword. So they're doing and they're victimizing kids. That's what they're doing.
So Libby, it took a long time before we got anywhere near gay rights in this country. You are painting a picture of what we can expect is going to come next in this terribly important area. So what happens? The only thing you can do, it seems to me, is to do what gays and lesbians did all along. You got to fight the fight, and sooner or later you win.
Yeah, we keep fighting. We just keep fighting, and that's the end of the conversation. I mean, it's not the end of the conversation, but what do? You have to keep fighting. You can't give up. We have to support transgender youth. We have to support transgender people. They're part of our community. We all have to come together and fight for these rights. And we need to do, you know, what we did. I mean, I was around in the 1980s, 90s here in Albany, and my political soulmate, Jim Perry, who died in 91, went to talk to the black clergy, you know, about the human rights ordinance here. And that's what we need to do. We have to restart those conversations with clergy. We have to restart those conversations with parents and with lawmakers. I mean, in New York, we have the gender pass. So, and the walking while trans bill passed. So we're okay here, sort of, but that doesn't mean violence doesn't happen. But in these other states, we have to keep fighting.
Just a moment on Jim Perry. I have to tell you, he was in my class, as were you. And we had a legislator come and talk about something. I don't remember what it was. And Jim Perry stood up in the back of that class and he really let him have it. I'll never forget it as long as I live.
Well, you know, he is, he's what fuels me every single day, to be quite honest with you.
Yeah.
Well, we are out of time. I want to thank you both. It's been a good morning. I want to thank Alan. Thank you, of course.
And thank you, Joe,
Libby, thanks for being here. Appreciate it. And we'll be back with more.